Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Eric Levitz from New York Magazine's Intelligencer will join us to explain why leftism doesn't sway non-voters, but according to recent polls, Bernie Sanders does. Heather Parton from Salon will work a little overtime this week, helping me run down a major week in the news. And our progressive candidate spotlight this week will be with Rebecca Parson, who's running for Congress in Washington's 6th District. If you're listening to the radio right now, you should know there's a free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. There's also a member show. You could support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio program without commercials and access to 10 years of our archives. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up now. Help me run down the news this week, Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, obviously a lot of news this week, and not the least of which we had the beginnings of the openings of the first public hearings from witnesses in regards to impeachment this week. We heard from on Wednesday from George Kent, who was a State Department official. We heard from Bill Taylor, William Taylor, who was the acting ambassador to Ukraine. And broad strokes. Let's just start broad strokes before we start getting into the narrow stuff. There was some new stuff that we did here that were amendments to the private depositions. I think it's new to most people, though, because I don't think that they read those released depositions. But just give me your broad stroke take, and then we'll get into the specifics in a bit.
Well, I think the broad stroke is this. I mean, we've all seen the rough transcript, or whatever they're calling it, the White House provided transcript of the call. And I think to most people, even ones who don't want to admit it, that call showed that the President of the United States was bribing, extorting the President of Ukraine to do some dirty work for him, for his domestic political benefit, in return for a visit to the White House, a public meeting with him, and the provision of $400 million worth of military aid that had already been appropriated by the Congress. We saw that. It's pretty clear. I mean, I don't think that most of us have trouble interpreting that. But the president has been out there from the very beginning saying there's nothing in that. You know, it's just sort of you can believe me or you can believe your lying eyes. There's nothing in that conversation. It was a perfect call. Everything was fine. There's no quid pro quo, et cetera, et cetera. And the Republicans have you know, sort of backed that up, that this is a perfectly acceptable call for the President of the United States to make, and there was no quid pro quo involved. These witnesses that came, that were featured on Wednesday, Kent and Taylor, They're both experts in the area. They both know a lot about the region. They know a lot about the politics, and they filled in a lot of gaps there. And made a case, I think, that was sort of important to kind of lay the groundwork here on why anyone should care if Ukraine got their military assistance. And, you know, they talked a bit about the national security implications of that and American leadership, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, but what they did most importantly was that they provided a boatload of evidence that this quid pro quo was being talked about by a whole bunch of people. Everybody was in on it. They had, you know, the acting ambassador, or the, I guess, the confirmed ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, Trump's lackey and, you know, big donor to the inauguration, along with his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and the envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker, were all working what Taylor called an irregular channel. In other words, they were doing this thing, trying to get this investigation or public statement about an investigation. I didn't even get this. They didn't really care about getting an actual investigation. They just wanted the president of Ukraine to go on CNN and tell the world that he was, you know, going to have an investigation. And you know, it's basically smeared Joe Biden and the DNC. And Hillary Clinton by implication, too, because he was talking about 2016. And in the process, of course, exonerate Russia from being the ones who had actually done the interference in 2016. So, you know, this, what they did was provide a lot of detail, and it was very credible, about the fact that they had, you know, what they used to say, their hair was on fire, because this thing was happening. It was not, you know, authorized by any sort of normal channels. It seemed to be, in their view, going against American national interest. And everybody was lying and, you know, running around doing these sort of secret meetings. And they were trying to figure out what this whole thing meant. And it was pretty clear to them that the president of Ukraine was being extorted based upon all these conversations that they had. So what the whole point of it was, and I think that Schiff and the Intelligence Committee were pretty smart in laying it out this way, was to just sort of lay down this basic idea that, you know, Trump can go out and say that read the transcript, you and I have talked a lot about that, you know, about how ridiculous that is, but go ahead and read the transcript. But now you've got all these other people saying what we've all been saying about that transcript, and they're under oath, they're appearing before Congress, and all of that sort of is laid out. And now that is going to be built upon over the course of the next few weeks as they go into this inquiry and build a case, I think, on the Ukraine extortion plot, which is essentially what it is.
Right. Well, my assessment, similar to yours, I have to say that I wasn't quite as sold on they brought George Kent in largely, and although I say that he actually seemed to be more relevant in the cross-examination part when he was being cross-examined, his
Agreed.
Testimony became more relevant and more poignant, I think, in that part of the testimony. But they brought Kent in largely to do what you'd said in terms of like providing the stakes in terms of Ukraine policy. And I suspect that is, you know, and we will talk more about this as we progress in this conversation. But I suspect that was more geared towards the Senate in many respects.
Yeah.
To reiterate why we have this Ukraine policy, largely speaking for the American public, I think the merits of our Ukraine policy are irrelevant. And, you know, I have some ambivalence a little bit about it, you know, in terms of how maybe we could have approached Ukraine better, you know, a decade ago or more. But regardless, the real issue was, I think, at least in terms of making the case at the beginning, as far as the Democrats want to do, was all with Bill Taylor, which was, and you could bring Kent in there and say, here's what stated U.S. policy is towards Ukraine. And here are, and at different points, I think Kent also did a very good job when he was asked by Hines from Connecticut, and we will talk again more specifically about that. and also Goldman, the counsel, when, you know, have you ever heard of a situation where a president asked for something specifically politically viable for him as a, you know, as a leverage point? And Kent was good in that regard. But I don't think that we needed to feel the import of the specifics of our policy, other than what was going on with these irregulars had nothing to do with our policy, because the thing that needed to be established, and I think it clearly was, though, by the end, was that Donald Trump was just out for himself in this whole thing. And that, I think, really, it landed. It took a little while because we had to get through the value of the Ukraine policy. But again, your mileage may vary. Speaking of mileage, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we will talk more about this. I'm Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio. Be right back with Digby. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Digby. So, Heather, we're talking the broad strokes of the testimony that we heard from Bill Taylor and George Kent earlier this week. On Friday, of course, Marie Yovanovitch, the former ambassador, the former United States ambassador to Ukraine, who was forced out because of... she was in some ways not with the game plan of what Bill Taylor called the irregulars. Bill Taylor set it up pretty well for us. He was the ambassador to Ukraine, or the acting ambassador to Ukraine, where he said there was a regular team essentially pursuing the U.S. foreign policy and a regular team. And he said at one point it became clear to him that the irregulars had a divergent agenda than the regulars. And that's when he started sounding sort of the alarm bells and whistles. And largely, the Republicans did not even attempt to impeach that narrative I just articulated. I think at one point, late in the hearing, one of the Republican congressmen tried to make the argument that, well, this is all hearsay, and you never met the president, so you can't possibly know what the president wants. And, you know, Bill Taylor and George Kent said, well, I'm just here telling you what I know. And what I know is Sondland and the EU ambassador appointed by Donald Trump, because he was a hotelier who gave $1 million to the inaugural committee, told him about this. That there were others in the NSC who relayed them to this. And they said, you know, I don't know what was in Donald Trump's mind, but I do know what I was told during the course of this. And we did see the implications of this. And certainly the Ukrainians by the end were worried about it. And we saw the reporting that happened in early September of 2018. And so the case was pretty well made from my perspective. What did you think about the way that the Democrats approach this, the whole idea of using counsel and forcing the Republicans to use counsel? Because not only I think that it helped the Democrats to use their attorney, I think it hurt the Republicans to use theirs.
It did. And I was frankly surprised by that. I mean, I think you could take a look at the two, you know, the chairman and the ranking member, Schiff, who is a Adam Schiff, the Democratic, head of the Intelligence Committee, is a lawyer, a Harvard trained, you know, former U.S. attorney. So, you know, I think we could assume that he knew how to do this sort of thing, that he was good at it, and he was. Whereas Devin Nunes, his Republican counterpart, isn't any of those things, and I expected that he wasn't going to be very good at it. But I thought they would get a good lawyer. to do the questioning on their side. I mean, Schiff had told them well ahead of time that they were going to do it this way. And Daniel Goldman, the person that was there for the Democratic side, was a highly, highly respected U.S. attorney from the Southern District of New York up until very recently, until like 2017. So, I mean, he's been in court recently too, and he was very effective, I thought, and it did show the other side being not just sort of second rate as, you know, lawyers. They seem to be really unprepared. I mean, it looked to me like their strategy was simply, you know, their strategy was to, you know, throw out whatever conspiracy theory crossed their mind. There wasn't even a case to be built about some conspiracy theory. They were after a whole bunch of them. I mean, Nunes was terrible, but I expected that. But the lawyer they had, his last name is Castor.
Yep.
Apparently, he's been with them for a while. He was on the Benghazi, witch hunt. And he was absolutely awful. I was so surprised that they couldn't find a lawyer of the caliber of Goldman. There are a lot of Republican lawyers. You know, I mean, a lot of, maybe they're, most of them are now on the bench that Trump has put them into judgeships, but there are a lot of them. And the idea that they couldn't come up with somebody who was better than that. And you mentioned what their greatest line of attack was and what would have made the most sense for them to do. They don't have a lot to work with because the facts are pretty clear. But what they could have said in terms of these two witnesses was hammer home that one thing that you said they brought up at the end, which is none of you have ever heard Donald Trump. You haven't talked to him. You didn't hear him say any of this. You don't know anything. You know, you don't have any direct knowledge of Donald Trump. And, you know, this is the impeachment of the president. It's not the impeachment of Gordon Sondland or Mick Mulvaney or anything. I mean, obviously, we're building a case toward Trump, but that would have been a logical thing for the lawyer to have done, the lawyer in particular to have done, which is really pound this point home. Look, you guys, that's nice that you're saying all this, right, but you don't really know what you're talking about. But he didn't do that, and I was stunned, and I was further stunned that nobody brought it up until the end of the questioning.
Yeah, I agree, and we just have less than a minute here, but I will say this, and we're gonna talk more about impeachment in this program, obviously, but I will say it was almost as if the lawyer was not given proper instructions because there was no case to be made in terms of refuting them. And they didn't really, he did not seem to have an agenda. He was more meandering. And I honestly, my first thought was, did they not tell this guy in advance that he was going to be doing this? Because it really did seem like, hey, we forgot. You're supposed to do the questioning. What? When is it? 45 minutes. Can you get it together? I'll deal with it. So I don't know. That was I was pretty shocked about that. But we're going to talk a lot more about impeachment. Of course, there's a lot of other stories. There's another trial that's going on dealing with the Trump administration that in many respects should be getting a lot more attention than it has been. But we got to take a break. Digby will join me in the next hour. I will be right back. Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, could Bernie Sanders convince non-voters to come out to the polls? I'm Sam Seder. We'll find out after the break. Hey, today's show was made possible in part by BetterHelp. BetterHelp is an online service. It gives you unlimited access to your own fully licensed therapist by way of phone, video, and chat. And they're giving Ring of Fire listeners 10% off your first month when you go to BetterHelp.com/ROF Radio. That's BetterHelp.com/ROF Radio. Look, this is how it works. You get paired up, and you'll be communicating with your therapist within 24 hours of signing up. You don't have to go into an office. You can do it from your home or wherever. If you're on the go, it doesn't matter. You can log into your account anytime and send messages to your therapist. You'll get a timely and thoughtful response. You can schedule your live meetings at any time that fit your schedule. And if you don't think your therapist is working out, if it's not a great match, you can switch to someone new at any time for no extra charge. It's more affordable than traditional in-person therapy. Financial aid is available, And you'll get 10% off your first month when you go to BetterHelp.com/ROF Radio. That's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/ROF Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Our next guest asked the question, should the Democratic Party prioritize winning over swing voters or inspiring already sympathetic non-voters? Here to help me answer that question, Eric Levitz from the New York Magazine's Intelligencer. So, Eric, there has been an ongoing conversation, and I can't, to be honest with you, tell if this dynamic has changed and therefore this debate has come up, or if this was ongoing in years past and I just wasn't aware of it, but I suspect it's the former. And there is this debate that your piece is premised upon about the differences between a persuasion and a mobilization election. And you've discussed this in the context of asserting that leftism isn't very appealing to non-voters, but Bernie Sanders is. So let's talk about, let's just get some terms defined before we enter into this. When we say leftism, what are we talking about? And when we talk about non-voters, who are these people? And then we can move on to who Bernie Sanders is. Walk us through those two terms in the context of your piece.
Sure. Yeah. So I think it's important to emphasize context here. This was an analysis largely of the Upshot and Siena College's polling of battleground states that came out last week, which, you know, is a fairly robust poll, but it is just, you know, one poll. Some of the arguments that I'm making are supported by other data, but anyway, I think the headline is a little bit more emphatic than I would maybe put it. But nonetheless, so leftism here is basically, I'm just describing as, there's this sort of idea, I think, that is prominent in progressive, inter-progressive debates about persuasion versus mobilization, which is that there's a real major tension between these two strategies. The reason we need to argue about this is because the reachable candidates in terms of persuasion, you're thinking of, especially in the Electoral College, white non-college voters in the Rust Belt who tend to lean right on a lot of cultural or social issues, at least that's how we describe them, especially immigration. And then you look at this non-voting population, which is a non-voting population that appears demographically to lean to the left. You've got low-income people, non-white people, young people. And so the presumption is that what to reach them, we really need a really robust platform on the very issues, robustly progressive platform on the very issues that are not our winners with these white people. So to get Latinos to the polls, we need to really emphasize immigration. To get young African-Americans, suppose we need to really emphasize police violence. And so we need to fundamentally choose which of these models, how do we want to win? And the data that Cohn produces suggests that this just actually doesn't appear to be the case.
When you say appear to be the case, what's not the case? I mean, so that we have this debate where it's, do we try and convince people who vote on a regular basis and maybe last time voted for Trump or voted for the Republican, do we try and convince them to vote for the nominee or, you know, the Democrat running in these races? Or do we attempt to mobilize those people who are generally, and I think when we talk about non-voters, maybe they're registered, maybe they're not. Often they are, but they just don't vote because for whatever reason. I mean, you know, we can speculate as to those reasons, and people do. And there's some polling, you know, I guess that would help out in that regard. But we bring them out. So what is not the case that is these numbers show?
Yeah. So what's not the case is that that these non-voters have really radically different views than the swing voters do. At least in Cohn's polling, what appears to be the case is that both these populations are low information voters with regard to politics. So to be like a swing voter in a country this polarized, typically you're going to be someone who doesn't pay that much attention to politics. Similarly, to be a non-voter, you probably don't pay that much attention to politics. And since ideological polarization and ideological, like, conformity and coherence is pretty driven by elites and the media, as far as, like, there's no, like, real inherent logical connection between being left-wing on healthcare policy and believing that we should have more immigration and believing that, you know, we really need police reform and that abortion is a fundamental right. Like, these ideas have maybe some affinity, but there's really no strong connection between them. And so what you see among voters who don't pay close attention to politics and don't get clear signals from the leaders of their party that they identify with about what people like them are supposed to believe, you end up with people with very heterodox views ideologically. And you see that among non-voters as well, such that in Cohn's polling, the non-voting African-Americans and this non-voting population of Democrats, so people who lean towards Democrats but are non-voters, and this is a much more diverse population than Democrats who vote. And yet this more diverse non-voting population is actually more likely to favor reduced immigration, more likely to say that there was 9 points more likely to say that discrimination against whites has become as big a problem as discrimination against blacks. They're not, basically the picture is that these non-voting Democrats appear to be, they're still a bit more liberal than these swing voters, but they're less liberal than ordinary Democrats, and especially on social issues, such that it appears that if you look at what they believe and what these swing voters, especially the non-college ones, believe, it seems like in both cases they agree with Democrats more on health care and inequality than on issues that we normally like code as racial issues, and that these are also maybe more top of the mind, more top like concerns for them. And so it doesn't appear like there is actually that strong a tension between the message that you would use to reach the swing voters and the message that you'd use to turn out these non-voting Democrats.
Okay, I see what you're saying. So from an ideological perspective, the reason why you would be a swing voter versus the reason why you would be a lean Democratic non-voter is marginal, I guess, is the best way to say it. To a large extent, is not determinant of whether you'll vote or who you vote for, right? I mean, so this is not, you cannot appeal to this Democratic lean non-voting group necessarily by a specific ideological meal, as it were, right? I mean, they're sort of a la carte, you're saying, and their connection to these ideological positions are, you know, tenuous, and they're just basically low information voters who, for whatever reason, and I guess this is really one of the big, this is the point, they don't feel compelled to vote if they're a non-voter, and the swing voters don't feel compelled to vote for one candidate or another based on ideology because they just don't think about ideology that much.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, obviously we're making generalizations, but
right.
But in the aggregate, yeah, don't care about ideology or feel very conflicted to the extent that they have ideology between the menu options from each party. Yeah.
Well, so yeah. So this is a good place for us to take a break, because if we've established through the data that generally speaking, non-voters are not staying on the sidelines because they have an ideological issue with the Democratic candidate, and that swing voters are not making their mind up based upon ideology of a Republican or a Democrat. The question then becomes, like, what motivates the swing voter and what motivates the non-voter to vote, if there's anything? And when we come back, we'll talk about that, because I suspect that is the other half of your piece, which is leftism isn't very appealing to non-voters, but Bernie Sanders is. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'm talking to Eric Levitz. Back in a second. back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Eric Levitz about his piece in New York Magazine's The Intelligencer. Leftism isn't very appealing to non-voters, but Bernie Sanders is. So, Eric, in the last segment, we were talking about, and there's some myths around this, the idea that, like, you know, persuadable voters, swing voters, are turned off by, you know, left-leaning politics or turned off by right-leaning politics or whatnot. And then there's the other sort of myth that's out there is that non-voters, and we're speaking generally, there's certainly, counterexamples to this, but non-voters who lean Democratic, the idea that they're not voting because they're not getting a, more left-wing policy prescriptions is incorrect, because generally Democrats who vote tend to be more to the left than those who are Democratic-leaning not voting. So the question becomes, specific to your piece, how do you get these non-voters to vote? Like, what causes them to vote if it's not necessarily an ideology?
Yeah, and I think that is still an open question, separate from this piece. There's been a lot of studies just demonstrating just how difficult it is to get people who don't vote to vote, and it's a real challenge that a lot of projects that have invested tremendous resources into doing so have failed. That said, if we're just going off of the survey data of what it seems like non-voting, what kind of message would appeal to this constituency, Cohn's data suggests that, you know, are they, it's incorrect to say that they're, you know, more left-wing than regular Democratic voters if you measure it by, like, just going policy by policy and adding it all together. Like, are you consistently giving a progressive-ish answer on each individual thing? But on certain questions, they do seem to have a more radical orientation, insofar as there's this very fascinating finding, which is that, you know, this both the non-voting Democrats and the undecided non-college-educated voters, people who vote regularly but don't have a strong party, both of those groups were a majority of them said that they preferred a moderate Democrat over a liberal one, but also said they preferred single-payer health care over a more incremental policy and a fundamental systemic change to American society over a return to politics as normal. So there's, you know, some dissonance here, but basically there's an anti-establishment attitude that, you know, which one would sort of make sense. Like, if you're still not sure which party you want to vote for, you ostensibly have a dissatisfaction with the two-party system to some extent, and that probably applies to non-voting Democrats as well. And so there's this general anti-establishment ethos that both of these demographics express in these polls, and not coincidentally, or one would think not coincidentally, these groups also, Sanders performs better with both of these groups than he does with voters in general, and he was also the easily the most popular Democrat among the non-voting Democrats. He was the only candidate who had a higher favorability among Democrats who don't vote regularly than Democrats who do, which suggests, I think, that a combination of things may make Sanders an effective general election candidate, or at the very least a more effective one than centrist pundits would be inclined to believe. Which is, one, the fact that he has been independent, registered independent for so long and defined his brand for so long as being a pox on both houses, which appeals to a significant sub-portion of the gettable voters in these states, both from the sidelines and, from Trump's coalition. There's an anti-establishment vote in rural Wisconsin that I think is inclined to, you know, vote for the socialist or the Trumpist, whatever's the promising big change. So there's that aspect. And then the second thing is that it does seem like Sanders is fairly good at refocusing any conversation around his core message on healthcare and inequality. And that does seem to be an optimal message for the Democratic nominee. So in those two respects, you can see Sanders potentially being an effective messenger in these states.
And so it's dispositional that I guess are cues that are pointing out to people that it's less about sort of a political ideology and more about a relationship to these voters' sense of alienation, which I think some people would argue is what was appealing to some members of the electorate about Donald Trump.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the theory that arises from this data, and that there's potential there to craft a more ideological coherence onto this, and ideally a more progressive ideological narrative onto this sort of inchoate sense of, being failed by the political class and being dissatisfied with the direction of the country. But at the moment, the polling suggests that it is somewhat mercurial, or that there are these competing impulses that the very same voters who are telling you they don't like liberal Democrats are also saying they want fundamental systemic change and the nationalization of the insurance industry. So,
right.
It's unclear.
Right, so we don't know if they're just responding to sort of like a brand essentially versus what you and I might know the policy implications of that brand.
Yeah, I think so, and I think that's true of a lot of other voters, but it's just that other voters who have. Whose intuitions about a certain subset of policies or value propositions that they actually do feel strongly about has made them identify with one party or the other.
And then right, they've already developed.
The party leaders have told them what they believe on everything else, and so they start to develop coherent overall ideologies, whereas this group doesn't trust either party's leadership enough to take sort of notes on what they're supposed to think or what people like them are supposed to think.
So how do we look at then 2018, right? Where we had, and this is true on both Republicans and Democrats, there were record breaking number of voters for an off year election. We saw something like this, I think, in the just most recent elections, but we don't really have the numbers quite yet to say that with any type of data specific definitiveness. But certainly in 2018, what we saw was Republicans coming out in record numbers, but Democrats coming out in even greater record numbers for an off-year election. Is how much does negative partisanship play into this? We just got about a minute or so left.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a big part of it. I think as far as the turnout picture for 2020 goes, the big question is one of the other things in Cohn's survey that I didn't get to is that the overall assessment is that actually, we used to always think high turnout benefits Democrats unambiguously. Now, because so many of these key elections are in these Rust Belt states with very high populations of non-college educated voters, and since those non-college educated white voters are moving right so sharply, it's actually now not entirely clear Republicans get a decent amount of benefit. Now that we're the ones who are relying on suburban voters who turn out really reliably, and they're relying on non-college educated ones, the turnout dynamic is muddled such that it's not, in their projections, it's not that much better to see uniformly high turnout for Democrats than a medium term out election. But obviously a lot depends on just which voters turn out. If Wisconsin's great masses of unregistered non-college educated white voters all decide that Trump is their savior and show up at the polls, it's going to be a disaster. But that seems not terribly likely to me. But
Eric Levitz, from your mouth to the ears, whoever pulls those levers in some of these swing states, always appreciate talking to you. Thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Eric Levitz is a senior writer at New York Magazine. When we come back, Heather Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Seder. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show. Ungo.